This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. British lawmakers rejected Prime Minister Boris Johnson's request for an election before the country's scheduled departure from the European Union next month.
The ayes to the right, 293. The noes to the left, 46. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it.
Opposition lawmakers voted against the measure or abstained. Johnson wanted a snap election on October 15, 2 weeks before the scheduled October 31st date for Brexit. But opposition parties said they wouldn't support an election until Britain had secured a delay to the Brexit date to ensure the country does not crash out of the bloc without a deal. The Prime Minister, without a loss of words, expresses frustration.
I earlier urged the House to trust the people, but once again the opposition think they know better. They want the British Prime Minister to go to a vital negotiation without the power to walk away. They want to delay Brexit yet again.
A report from the New York Times says that the U.S. Commerce Secretary threatened to fire political appointees at the National Weather Service for contradicting U.S. President Trump, who said 2 weeks ago that Hurricane Dorian was headed for the U.S. state of Alabama. While a very early forecast map showed a slight chance Dorian would strike the state, all revised forecasts said it would see no impact from the storm. Mr. Trump sent out several tweets insisting Alabama would be hit. The National Weather Service office in Birmingham, Alabama, tweeted a contradiction. No impacts from Hurricane Dorian will be felt in Alabama. The report says Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross telephoned the acting chief of National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Neil Jacobs, ordering him to repair the damage done by the tweet. On Friday, the agency, which is in charge of the National Weather Service, released an unsigned press statement criticizing the Birmingham office. This is VOA News. Israel has revealed what it says is a secret Iranian nuclear weapons development site. In a televised presentation at Israel's foreign ministry Monday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu showed what he said were satellite images and map coordinates of the nuclear site in central Iran. Netanyahu said the information came from nuclear archives that Israeli agents stole from Iran's capital, Tehran, in early 2018. Netanyahu said Iran used the site to conduct experiments to develop nuclear weapons without elaborating. Iran long has insisted its nuclear ambitions are peaceful. Netanyahu urged the international community to join U.S. President Donald Trump's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Cleanup continues after Hurricane Dorian ravaged the Bahamas Islands last week, with the death toll currently at 45, but it is expected to rise. Emergency worker Joseph Hillhouse of Florida Urban Search and Rescue said his team is expecting more bodies to be found as they comb through debris on one island.
Based off of our sample, I would say yes. So, you know, we've probably hit at most one-tenth of this area, and we found five human remains. So I would say based off of our sample size, we're going to see more.
And U.S. President Donald Trump is denying that he overruled his advisors in scheduling talks with the Taliban at Camp David, which he abruptly canceled this weekend. Mr. Trump said that he canceled the meeting after the Taliban carried out an attack last Thursday in Kabul that killed a U.S. Army soldier and 11 other people. U.S. news outlets reported that Vice President Mike Pence and the administration's national security advisor, John Bolton, voiced objections to holding the meeting on American soil. Trump told reporters Monday it was his idea to schedule the meeting and his idea to cancel it. Pence tweeted his support Monday, saying media outlets had not contacted his office before running the story. He said he fully supports the president's decision. An escalation of violence cannot solve social issues in Hong Kong. That's according to the leader of the Chinese-ruled city, Carrie Lam, on Tuesday, adding that she deeply regretted interference by foreign parliaments in the Asian financial hub's matters. Lam was speaking after another weekend of sometime violent clashes in the former British colony, with police firing tear gas to disperse protesters and cat-and-mouse skirmishes, at times smashing windows and starting street fires. During a rally at the U.S. consulate on Sunday, thousands of demonstrators called for help in bringing democracy to Hong Kong. Protesters wanted the U.S. Congress to pass legislation that would require Washington to make an annual assessment of whether Hong Kong is sufficiently autonomous from mainland China. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, September the 10th, and here are some of the stories that we're covering for you this morning. South Sudan President Salva Kiir and his former first vice president Riek Machar met in Juba yesterday ahead of the country's November 12th deadline to form a unity government. And the body of former Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe, who died last week, is expected to be repatriated from Singapore on Wednesday. Chartered plane left the country Monday with a delegation including Vice President Kembo Mohadi to facilitate the repatriation of the body of the former leader.
On Saturday, 14th September, the body will be taken to the giant National Sports Stadium, where members of the diplomatic corps, all other Zimbabweans, will once again be given a chance to be held and pay last respects to the Pan-African icon.
That is Monica Matvangwa, Zimbabwe's Minister of Information. The South African Communist Party is not happy with the way its government is responding to the recent xenophobic violence that is targeting African foreign nationals in the country.
There is an economic problem of high levels of unemployment. Inequality and poverty are also entrenched. But state organs established to combat crime and corruption have been weakened.
That is Alex Mashello, spokesperson of the South African Communist Party. Stay tuned, we have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And we begin in South Sudan, where President Salva Kiir and his former first vice president Riek Machar met in the country's capital, Juba, yesterday, ahead of the country's November 12th deadline to form a unity government. The talks are injecting new energy into the peace agreement process, but observers say that officials run the risk of missing another critical target. The earlier deadline of May 12th to form a transitional government of national unity was missed after the parties failed to meet critical benchmarks, including security arrangements. The body of former Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe, who died last week, is expected to be repatriated from Singapore on Wednesday. Zimbabwe Information Minister Monica Mtsvangwa confirmed that a chartered plane left the country Monday with a high-powered delegation, including Vice President Kembo Mohadi, to facilitate the repatriation of the body of the former leader, who has been receiving treatment for an undisclosed illness in Singapore since April. While details are not clear about the various venues citizens can pay their last respects, Ms. Vangwa could not disclose the place where the man who ruled the country since independence in 1980 would be buried, fueling speculation of tension between the government, the ruling ZANU-PF party, and Mugabe's family. The ruling party, which Mugabe presided over until his forced resignation in 2017, had expelled a former leader and his wife from the party that he founded.
Government has dispatched a delegation headed by the Vice President, Comrade Kembo Mohadi, to Singapore, and they are there expected to accompany the body of our dear founding father, Comrade Robert Mugabe, back home. The body is expected in Zimbabwe on Wednesday and on Thursday to cater for all the Zimbabweans from the 10 provinces who may want to pay their last respects. His body will be in Rufaro Stadium to allow members of the public to pay their last respects to the illustrious Liberation War hero. On Saturday, 14th September, the body will be taken to the giant National Sports Stadium, where members of the diplomatic corps, foreign dignitaries, and all other Zimbabweans will once again be given a chance to bid farewell and pay last respects to the Pan-African icon. And burial will be on Sunday.
Many Zimbabweans would want to know where the former president will be buried. Is there any decision on that yet?
Like I've already said, I'll be giving you more updates as they come from the committee which is sitting, going through those arrangements.
There are reports from other media outlets to the effect that the family, the Mugabe family, is very bitter to the extent of vowing not to allow President Mnangagwa to preside over the funeral of the former president. May you clear the air here?
That information has not come to my attention. I'm not aware of that.
Was the former president still a member of ZANU-PF?
As I said, the former president is the founding father of this country. He dedicated his life to the liberation of this country. He is truly a gallant soul, a gallant son of this fam, a revolutionary icon and a Pan-Africanist. So his contribution to the history of this country and even the continent can never be forgotten.
That was Monica Mzivangwa, Zimbabwe's Minister of Information. She was speaking to Jonga Kandemiri of the VOA Zimbabwe service from Harare. Nigerians living in Cameroon are calling on both their government and host country to come to their aid after at least 20 Nigerians were killed in separatist violence. Some traders who have been stranded in safer towns because of the violence say that they have lost all their goods. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Hundreds of Nigerians in the company of Cameroonians pray and sing at St. Joseph's Anglophone Parish in Cameroon's capital, Yaounde. They are praying for peace in Cameroon's restive English-speaking regions. Among the worshippers is 27-year-old Ngozi Esther. Esther says she, her husband and three children escaped from the English-speaking northwestern town of Kumbo after suspected separatists attacked them 1 week ago.
I pleaded with them that I am a Nigerian, but they have insisted that since they are using the money from the taxes I pay to buy weapons and kill Anglophones, I'm supporting the crisis. And they burnt all of my goods and they destroyed everything I was doing.
Separatists in North and Southwestern Cameroon ordered all businesses to close to protest to lifetime prison sentence given to their leader Ayuk Tabe by a military tribunal in Yaounde. Joseph Ukambila, president of the Nigerian Union in Yaounde, says they have taken in at least 100 Nigerians who fled the crisis. He says many of them were kidnapped and released only after ransoms were paid.
Nigerians in that two region have suffered a lot. You know, we don't depend on salaries, we depend on our business. And when you see they are not doing business, they have children, they have house rent to pay, they have electricity bill to pay, water bill to pay, and other things. They are suffering a lot. Many of them have packed to Yaounde.
It is estimated that between 4 and 5 million Nigerians live in Cameroon, the majority living in the English-speaking regions. The government has advised foreigners who feel threatened to leave, but says it is protecting everyone. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
And from Cameroon, we go to South Africa, where the country is reeling from xenophobic attacks for over a week. The country grapples for answers as the attacks on foreign-owned businesses continued over the weekend, with more people killed. VOA's Salem Solomon explores the root of the anger toward foreign nationals in the country and has this story.
Zarihun Dabo, an Ethiopian shopkeeper, surveyed the wreckage of his neighborhood store in Johannesburg, South Africa, after looters pillaged it.
I can't even express what happened. It is so heavy. It is very difficult.
Zarihun is one of the victims of xenophobic attacks that have spread across the country in recent weeks, killing at least 10 people and destroying the livelihoods of many more. In an interview with VOA's Amharic service, Zarihun pondered his future and that of other foreigners living in South Africa.
I used to sell bottles in my store, but I have no hope in this country. After working hard and building something for so many years and losing it all at once, it's ugly.
Attacks against foreigners in South Africa are not new. According to the website XenoWatch, which tracks such incidents, more than 500 attacks occurred between 1994 and 2018. The attacks seemed to spike periodically. More than 100 attacks in 2008 left more than 60 people dead, and more than 70 attacks occurred in 2015. This year is on track to be another violent one, with more than 40 incidents reported. More than half of the incidents unfolded in Johannesburg, the country's largest city. The roots of the anger against foreigners are difficult to pin down. South Africa is home to about 3.6 million foreign nationals, who make up about 7% of the population. The majority, about 70%, come from the neighboring countries of Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Lesotho, the BBC reported. Some politicians and officials have amplified the widely held belief that foreigners own an outsized share of businesses in the country, particularly in the poorer townships. At a press conference recently, South Africa's former Deputy Minister of Police, Bongani Mokongi, claimed the residents of the Hillborough neighborhood of Johannesburg are 80% foreign-born.
We fought for this land from a white minority. We cannot surrender it to the foreign nationals. That is a matter of principles. We fought for this country, not only for us, for the generations of South Africans. The arms that are being used here in Hillbrow are arms of war.
But the fact-checking website Africa Check examined his claim and found it to be false. Anger against foreigners dates back decades, said Jean-Pierre Misago, a researcher at the African Center for Migration and Society at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. Because of the oppressive restrictions of apartheid, black people were forced to live in poor areas known as townships. When immigrants arrived and looked for business opportunities, they often found these same townships were the only places where they could afford to open shops. This, said Misago, bred anger and resentment.
When they go to those areas, some local groups feel threatened by their presence because they're saying, you are taking our business space, you are undermining our businesses, we are now competing with you for scarce jobs and scarce resources, and we don't want that.
He added, political leaders unable to deliver services and jobs for their constituents often scapegoat immigrants.
The government is not able to deliver basic services to those areas. And to justify those service delivery failures, they blame those failures on the presence of a national. Say, look, if you don't find medicine in your clinic, it's because of a national. There are too many that are taking everything away from you.
In response to recent spate of attacks, some South African politicians are now seeking to cool their rhetoric. President Cyril Ramaphosa said there's no justification for the violence and convened security ministers to develop a response plan. In an interview with VOA's Peter Claudie, Garish Gardi, the general secretary of South Africa's Economic Freedom Fighters Political Party, said the killing of Africans by other Africans is unacceptable and must be punished.
Africa was a borderless continent. The borders were imposed to us by the imperialists and colonialists. And we shall continue to condemn such conduct by the communities against our fellow brothers and sisters from the other part of Africa.
Solomon Solomon, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
Meanwhile, the South African Communist Party says that it is not happy with the South African government's response to the recent xenophobic violence targeting African nationals in the country. The party, which is in alliance with the governing African National Congress, says that security agencies need to step their efforts to investigate and prosecute the masterminds of the attacks and looting of goods and destruction of property. The remarks followed the conclusion of the SAP's Central Committee meeting on Sunday. Alex Mashello is the spokesperson of the South African Communist Party. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the party has outlined recommendations which, if implemented by President Cyril Ramaphosa's government, could eliminate instances of xenophobic violence.
If law enforcement agencies perform their work and deal decisively with criminality, there will be peace in South Africa. But state departments must also perform their work and turn around the economy of South Africa. We also need to talk to other Southern African countries that are affected by economic collapse and then be able to also turn around those economies.
This is not the first time that xenophobic violence have been happening in South Africa. What does your party attribute to this?
There is an economic problem of high levels of unemployment. Inequality and poverty are also entrenched. But state organs established to combat crime and corruption have been weakened. And unless we deal decisively with the weakening of state organs established to combat crime and corruption, we are not going to become successful in dealing with the problem. Because these organs show that they are incompetent, firstly, in dealing with the day-to-day criminality that communities are complaining about. There is anger in communities, and this anger results partly in what we refer to as xenophobic attacks.
Is the SACP, the Communist Party, pleased with the response of the government so far?
No. The government could have done better a long time ago, but at that time, it was not able to act because of state capture. Fortunately, those who were in charge then were removed. The new government, led by President Cyril Ramaphosa, has to do its work 24 hours a day, turn around the economy, clean the whole of government of corrupt people, and strengthen the capacity of state organs established to deal with criminality and violence.
That the South Africa Communist Party is partly to blame for this ongoing drug abuse and unemployment because you are in alliance with the African National Congress, which has been running the affairs of the country. So why isn't the South Africa Communist Party taking responsibility as part of this ongoing xenophobic problems currently ongoing in South Africa?
All South Africans know that the SACP, the South African Communist Party, is the one that initiated the campaign to sort out the South African problems. Sorting out this campaign, you will recall that previously this campaign took the form of the campaign to remove the former president, Jacob Zuma. Now, you cannot blame the people who took a lead in solving South Africa's problem. You can't blame them for taking a lead in solving the problem. So blaming the SACP is to blame the force that took leadership to solve South Africa's problems. Being in alliance with the ANC does not make the SACP and the ANC a single organization and does not make everybody in the ANC guilty of what is going on in government.
That is Alex Mashello, spokesperson of the South African Communist Party, speaking to VOA's Peter Clotty. This year, 2019, marks 25 years since the genocide in Rwanda. It comes against the backdrop of increased attacks targeting immigrants and minorities in places like South Africa, the US, and other countries around the world. These attacks have led some experts to raise questions about the links between inflammatory speech online and the violent acts, especially the role of social media in amplifying hate speech. Professor Zachary Kaufman is the Associate Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Houston Law Center. He tells me that as the world commemorates the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi, it needs to wake up to these trends in hate crimes around the world and the role that social media is playing in sowing discord targeting minority groups.
Hate speech is dangerous, of course. You know, during the genocide, as you well know, and also in the years leading up to the genocide, Hutu extremists monopolized and manipulated local media to differentiate, dehumanize, and demonize Tutsi in such propaganda, which characterized this Tutsi minority as Inyinzi, which is the Kinyarwanda word for cockroaches, or Nzoka, which means snakes, and Ibitso, which means traitors. It really helped to mobilize hundreds of thousands of other Hutu to attack Tutsi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, today here in the United States, there's great concern about such discriminatory discourse. And conservatives and liberals alike have been accused of employing such rhetoric, some of it even resembling such genocidal propaganda. Most notably, of course, critics of President Trump, his rhetoric and his conduct, they often describe his behavior as even exemplifying, you know, racism and xenophobia and sexism and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And if we look back to the genocide in Rwanda, some of this discourse really is shockingly similar.
Similar to what is happening right now. Now, in Rwanda, one of the tools that was used by the Hutu extremists to carry the anti-Tutsi propaganda was a radio station, RTLM. In this era of social media, where everyone who has access to a phone also has access to social media, are there any parallels, and what can we do as a society either to regulate some of the speech that we see on the internet, in these platforms like social media, so that we don't have a repeat of 1994 in Rwanda?
You're absolutely right, Jackson, that there are disturbing parallels between the incitement of the genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda and incitement against other minority groups today, so including in genocidal context. So, for example, and you mentioned social media. Social media has been blamed, particularly Facebook, has been blamed for playing a role, being exploited to incite the genocide against the Rohingya in Myanmar. Facebook has been accused severely of being used by genocidal inciters to spread such hateful rhetoric and to help organize the genocide. And so the question is, what to do? I think that there's now a much better appreciation for the role that social media can play in inciting, just as radio, and I would add the newspaper, Kangura, played during the genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda in 1994. And so the question is what to do today about social media. Facebook should certainly do a better job of monitoring and, where appropriate, taking down content that's inciting. Mm. And we should all be paying better attention to the role that social media plays in all of our lives.
Research shows that with over 2 billion monthly users, Facebook is the biggest social network worldwide. The platform has received criticism for its role in promoting violence. I asked Professor Kaufman if Facebook has the same level of effectiveness in sowing discord as Rwanda's notorious RTLM radio.
Absolutely, I do. In Myanmar, we were just talking about Facebook is so prominent and is used so widely that some people even mistake it for the internet. They actually think it's the internet itself. And so given its, such widespread usage throughout the country, just as so many people during in the years leading up to the Rwandan genocide, the genocide against the Tutsi, were listening to the radio, social media is a parallel tool to radio from 1994 in inciting genocide. Now, all of this is not to say that, social media, is all bad, of course. I mean, tools can be used for good or ill. And I can imagine situations, of course, where radio as well as social media could also be used to combat genocide as well by raising public awareness about, what's happening, about stockpiling of weapons, about treatment of minority groups, and trying to persuade people to resist and to become involved as upstanders.
That is Professor Zachary Kaufman. He's the Associate Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Houston Law Center. Professor Kaufman has specialized in transitional justice and genocide studies, particularly regarding the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda. And that's it for this Tuesday, September the 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this morning with us. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very productive week ahead, Africa.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the biggest threat to President Yoweri Museveni's re-election in 2021 may be a 37-year-old musician. The future of Uganda on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.